This is Screen Divers. On this week's episode, we are talking about Blood Simple, directed by Joel Coen, written by the Coen brothers, Joel and Ethan, produced by Ethan, starring John Getz, Francis McDormand, Dana Dyer, Sam Art Williams, and Mark Emmett Walsh. Cinematography by Barry Sonnenfeld, edited by Roderick Janes, music by Carter Burwell, produced by River Road Productions and Foxon Entertainment, distributed by Circle Films, and it came out in 1984. This movie has a running time of 96 minutes, and it was made for a budget of $1.5 million. How are you, Steve?
All good on my side.
How are you, Ricky?
I'm good.
Whose pick was this, man? This pick was... The person who picked this movie is not here today.
No, it's not here.
No.
But that's absolutely fine.
This movie was picked by someone who was meant to guest on this episode. His name is David Joshua Smith. He's a member of the Friends of Our Weekly group. And we miss you, Dave. He's going to join us on another episode. He had unforeseen circumstances and he couldn't take part. However, we would like to collectively thank you for picking this movie. Because I'm going to come right out and say it. It's the only Coen Brothers movie that I have never seen.
Mm. I'm just going to reiterate this point as well. I have never seen this movie. I thought I had seen this movie. Mm. I've seen a completely different movie.
Did you watch Blood Complex? Like, I don't
know. Probably.
Okay.
Or was it like A Simple Plan? Because that normally gets confused with this.
It's possible.
Movie.
It's possible. Mm. I'm sitting down and watching it with Umba, and we're both like, fuck, we haven't seen this movie.
Yeah, it was a delight in every possible way. But before we do any of this, Ricky, what's this movie about?
Imagine you're in the middle of Texas. You're surrounded by the heat, the sweat, the waves of flies, and there's a bar. A bar that kind of feels like that it shouldn't belong in Texas, but it does. And it's owned by Julian Marty, who is a disgraceful human being who knows that his wife is having an affair. Hilarity ensues.
that's what the movie's about. The movie plays out like a pulpy novel. It really feels like an Elmer Leonard novel. Mm. It really did for me. And then I looked it up. Apparently, the entire movie was inspired by a sentence or an expression in a novel called Red Harvest, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
But then I went online, and because obviously it's not part of my lexicon, nor yours, guys, but I'm going to start using it. Well, I had to look up the definition of Blood Simple, as in something that you throw into a sentence. And when you... I'm going to start using it now because several times in my life I have been blood simple or I've done something that can be considered blood simple. What does it mean? Well, how would you use it? Well, what I found was blood simple refers to a state of mind or an emotional condition characterized by confusion, turmoil, or lack of clarity. It is often associated with intense emotions such as fear, anxiety, and paranoia that can cloud one's judgment and perception, leading to impulsive or irrational actions. And that's what this fucking movie is about.
It is.
Every single character in this movie has little to no clue of what's happening, but one character. And the only character that's actually strategizing the entire thing makes one crucial mistake, but everyone else is reacting on impulse. It's including Maurice, which is the bartender.
Yeah.
But we'll talk about all of them, I guess. But I said it, you know, it was a delight. I now rank this in the top three. And not to mention the fact that when I say it was a delight, we always talk about Chekhov's gun. There is a literal Chekhov's gun in this. I have never put that much emphasis behind what a gun could create in a movie. There's a level of suspense brought in by an object in this until the end. Because once you realized that there's one bullet left, you'll spend the rest of the movie waiting for that bullet to be fired. And I adored it. I adored what it did to me. Every single detail is chef's kiss.
Yeah. I'll agree with you on that.
So this wasn't my first time. This was Sally's first time. And I remember sitting down with her thinking to myself, you do not know what's about to hit you. There is a lot that's going to suddenly come at you, and you will not know what's about to hit you. When I first saw this film, I must have been about 17. And of course, going on a little bit of a Coen Brothers bent. And I think it was on Film 4 one night as part of like a Coen Brothers season. I sat down and I watched it. And I think I had a similar feeling towards this film as I did to a David Lynch film or a Cronenberg film. A sort of like, I think I know what I've watched. I know I've followed the plot line as much as possible. Was I missing something? And I think watching it this week, I definitely know I didn't miss a beat when I was younger. Yeah. But I think I'm starting to see the formula of the Coen Brothers, which I'll talk about.
And not
about
just
later
that,
on.
You also have your life, like you have your life experience accruing over time, and your perception of this movie changes because you fucked up several times. I assume if we're friends, you must have fucked up. Obviously, we're not talking about, oh, Umba, I need to fucking hide a body. I fucked up. You know, although if I get that phone call, I'll go, hey, man, I would help you, but you're in Australia. Sorry, click. But the idea is that, we've had colossal fuck-ups when we were younger, you know, strong experiences, and this movie is about that. Because I was trying to work out, what the fuck is John Gatz doing here? But as the movie progresses, I thought, holy shit. And then after reading the Blood Simple definition, he's exactly in that state. And I did say that to Steve. I said, because Steve said, why is he doing this? Why is it? And I was saying that as well. And then I realized, wait a second, the guy's in fucking shock, dude.
Yeah.
And he's in shock because the movie basically happens over the core of the movie happens over a 48-hour period. And you would be. You would be without sleep, without eating, without... You would be in a continuous, because you've never killed anybody before. And yeah, you watch the movies, you watch this, you watch that. But there's no, and the mistakes that he makes are critical and you shout at the screen. But at the same time, they're plausible. There's a ton of plausibility. Even when he's trying to fucking clean the blood with his shirt and you think, what the fuck are you doing? And Steve is shouting, DNA, DNA. I get it, man. It's.
I just want to pick up from where you are there and just say that there's one moment afterwards where he goes, where's my top? And he's already throwing it away into the blaze.
Mm-hmm.
So he does not know what he's doing. He's running on absolute adrenaline and fear.
At the beginning, you think he's overacting. And then that's really hard to act, I thought. Yeah. But at the same time, as we're watching John Gatz act, I kept thinking of fucking Ricky doing a James Spader, like uttering the lines. That, I don't know why, but he was uttering the lines that John Gatz had in The Fly, like James Spader. I was like, what? It's cock. Like, you remember that?
Oh, yeah. What? Like that? Do you like his cock?
Yeah. For our listeners, what are you talking about, Umba? Well, you should say that every time I open my mouth, but you probably do. But we're talking about the Fly episode, and John Gatz is one of the three protagonists of that film. He's barely recognizable.
Yeah, and he's an awful character in The Fly.
Yeah, unlike in this one. Like, you know, he makes mistakes, and he's, you know, he's a loser, technically. Ray is a loser. He's not, you know, he's no one to aspire to. He's, you know, about to hit middle age. He's just working behind the bar barely. You know, he doesn't have the trust of his peers. And he gets treated like a fuck-up as well by the people around him. Not to mention the fact that the movie opens with a crucial fuck-up. He has an affair with a married woman. He does realize that. But he's not necessarily... But he's not a bad guy. He's just a bit of a, you know... And I think the Coen brothers have written this character before. You know, because this is a serious movie, but it's the closest we probably get to the dude, I think.
Yeah.
It's just that the dude hasn't been involved in, you know, I think the setting is much more comedic.
Mm.
But if you look at Ray, he's just like a boat in a storm. There's very little influence he can exert here. And whenever he tries to to take action, he does it half-assed. Like, the entire, man, I also never realized, like, it's not the first time that I watched this movie. I think there was an attempt in the past, and I can't remember I can't remember when. I do remember that I tried, and I blame myself for not sticking with it, because this is a phenomenal, Mark M. Walsh's performance is glorious. I mean, I adore the guy. We lost him last year, you guys. You know that, right?
Yeah.
Last year. He was a phenomenal actor. He was humble as a person as well, apparently. He pops up everywhere. And whenever he pops up, I sent you guys a clip. I sent you a clip from a movie that is it's criminally underrated with Michael Keaton called Clean and Sober. I don't know if you've seen it.
Not seen it.
But the clip I sent you is of Mark Emmett Walsh talking to the cameras fixed on him. And I think it's in the opening of the film. But if it's not, it's in there. And it's a brilliant performance. It's a monologue. And the setting is an AA meeting. So he's recollecting something that has happened to him. If you guys are interested in checking this out, and if you're not, you should be, go on YouTube, type in M. Emmett Walsh, Clean and Sober. And the first thing you get is that monologue. Because if you've ever had a stint with any substance abuse or alcohol or whatever else, then perhaps you can relate a little about that story, about what he says in that story. If not, then it's compelling and you shouldn't. You shouldn't abuse anything. It's much more powerful than you thought. Frances McDormand is so young in this, dude. Mm. But she's not green. Her performance is super believable. You know, you could see that there's a star there. Like,
yeah.
She's super. I never suspended disbelief in this. Do you understand that? Like, it's a tale that is larger than life. And I did not suspend disbelief once. I didn't go, oh, no. No, instead, what you do when there are mistakes being made, particularly by Ray's Odyssey, it's just a disaster. You just look like, no, don't do that. And then until you stop doing that and you start going, oh, no, but he's in shock, man. That's what he's doing. So you actually keep adding plausibility to it, which is weird to do that to a viewer, man. I'm spellbinded. I want to watch it again. Not to mention the fact that the way Sonnenfeld played with light here is
so well done.
The shots are so pretty. This movie, and then the movie just turns around and it turns into a slasher, and it's amazing. It's amazing. Sorry, guys. Jump in, man. Like, I'm just very excited. Jump in. Yeah.
So, but with me, I think the soundtrack is really, really well used.
Yes.
And not just, there's a classic track, it's the same old song from Four Tops, and it's used really, really well in the movie.
But that's,
because it's only Four Tops, yeah, but it's used twice. And the first time you hear it, it's pretty much at the beginning of the movie, where you get Maurice,
but Sam the way Williams. Maurice does that as well.
Yeah, and it's just that little dance on top of the bar, it gets over, but we can see that it's setting something up later.
Yeah, it's also announcing the fact that you don't fuck with Maurice.
Yeah.
Because when you look around that bar, it's full of icks.
Yeah.
And he's black, and this is Texas. And when he jumps over the bar top, he does a 1-2 step, and I thought, oh, he's dancing. But guess what? Then I spent the rest of the movie thinking, this guy looks like a boxer. This guy looks like a boxer. I didn't even check it. I'm pretty sure that this guy is a boxer, because the 2-step he does over the bar top looks like a dance. That looks like a boxer skipping, dude. That's what that does. And the fact that he goes to play like a soul-like tune and the bar is packed with hicks and it's not country, it means he doesn't give a fuck. He plays what he wants to play, and that's good. Because nobody's going to fuck with Maurice.
Well, yeah, not even the bar owner, Marty, kind of fucks with him, because Maurice kind of redirects him away from Deborah, who he's chatting up. And it's done so smoothly. And we learn later on that Julian Marty, played by Dan Hedaya, he is not someone to mess with. He is someone who will shoot first, think later.
Absolutely.
Which is quite funny, because this film treats him in the first like 10, 15 minutes as a bit of the idiot of the piece.
Yes. However, I go as far as telling you that this, because Denadaya grew up in Brooklyn, okay? And he kept his Brooklyn accent for this.
Mm.
Yeah? It comes out. It comes out and you hear it. Without any background on this guy, you kind of can easily... I think there's a series at the moment with Sylvester Stallone that people should watch because it's actually really good. It's a Paramount Plus series called Tulsa King. Yeah. And it's about a scenario in which someone who's, you know, basically snitched on the mob needs to move to the middle of nowhere. And guess what happens when you move to the middle of nowhere? I mean, we watched The Razor and we had Roberto Pastorelli ending up behind the bar, tending bar. Well, in this case, it seems to me that this guy is, you know, a career criminal who's snitched on the mob. Because then later on, there's another allusion to this, which is, I'll make a phone call, don't worry. You know, like it's... So the very thing you said, yeah, I agree with. But it's also establishing something else, which is... I think that scene establishes Maurice as being someone that you don't fuck with. Because he's imposing, yeah?
Mm.
But then, all of a sudden, you have this little guy with a Brooklyn accent who comes in, who's the owner. And we, you know, just a wave of the hand establishes, don't fuck with me either, basically. Because I'll make you disappear. And there is this constant threat of this because at the back of this bar, there's an incinerator. And there's an evil element to it because we waited the entire film for this thing being used in a particular way.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's always burning. It's always burning throughout the movie. It's like, who's going to end up in there? You know, at one point, we thought that's how Ray is going to get rid of the... But it didn't happen. But there was a moment in which you think, and he thinks about it.
Yeah.
But he doesn't have it in him because this is like burning a body, you know. So he puts it in the car. It's like, I need to go for a drive. Anyway, let's.
Yeah,
we're not going to a play by play.
I'm just going to do something really quick. Williams is a 6'8" lefty, and he was a sparring partner for Muhammad Ali.
Thank you very much. I did not have to check that. So when I did see the two-step on the bar top, I thought, okay, yeah, look, it's dancing. That's kind of cool. But then in my head, I played those few frames again, and I thought, no, with Italian or something, this is a box skip.
Yeah.
A boxing skip. Thank you for that, Steve.
No worries.
Ricky?
Yeah, so what I was going to say, going back to the whole Marty thing, is you're right. At the very start, you get the phone call, and he's like saying, you're having fun? You still there? Oh, yeah? And all this stuff. And then he has the meeting with Visser. I can't remember how he pronounces
it. Because call him Lauren Visser.
Visser. Because his accent, like, is the best
accent
ever.
He's not from the South.
No, he's not. But it's so it hits all the musical notes.
It does, but it's actually not an accent either. Like, I looked it up online. I saw an interview with him saying, you know, I'm doing my own thing. Well, you're doing a great thing, man. Yeah.
It was the same. It's the same thing with Raising Arizona. That is not a specific regional accent. And as the Coen brothers said, it's meant to be an accent about people who just either read the Bible or read magazines. And that's the only things they read in their life.
Yeah,
you know, you can hear it. You can hear the musicality, almost biblicalness of the lines, followed by the, and I was just a thinking, and all of that stuff playing.
Even if the conversation has horrible undertones,
he
still manages to bring a very jovial kind of hospitable nature. Because, you know, the South is a hospitable. It's, you know, I was listening to an episode of This Episode Everybody Dies, and Kev, Chad, and Ben were talking about Southern hospitality. It's just a coincidence that I actually listened to that episode, and then that very same day, the night we watched Blood Simple. It's very true. I think it was on the Sling Blade episode, which it's another movie that I need to revisit. They made me, you know, that podcast is so good. I want to go and watch the movie again after I listen to their episodes. But there's a... I think he brings levity to this movie at points, almost. But he turns into like a monster. Like he is a monster. Like he's the only person strategizing throughout this, like he's done it several times before.
Yeah.
Look, another thing for our viewers, this is a neo-noir thriller. And at the, you know, I could say at the risk of spoiling this, but there's something. This movie cannot be spoiled, I think. This movie doesn't rely on a twist in the tail. It doesn't rely on, oh, I didn't see that coming. Not for me. What this movie relies on is in giving you details that will hit back later. And if you pay attention to what's happening, what this movie does to you and the level, it's an exercise in excellent suspense. Because you know what's coming. You're waiting for it to come. You don't know in what form it will come, but there will be every single detail, every single sequence, everything portrayed in this movie is there for a reason. And I really, really, really like that. We were talking about Chekhov's gun, and I've never seen how powerful an object like a gun all the way through the movie. This thing has an aura. You know what? I know you guys have tabs open, and it was going to be my research for this episode. I did not do the research. I was thinking about it yesterday. So we're going to go on the hunt, because it's very exciting for anybody to hear us go tap, tap, tap while we look for info. They can find themselves online. What model is that fucking gun?
38 Special. I can remember it. It's pill-handled 38 Special. I don't even need to look at the camera stuff.
Ricky, just see Steve's face. It just came.
Oh, my God.
Did you see how ready he was with that?
Yeah, he was.
Yep. Shit, mate.
He was a little bit too ready.
Yeah.
Do you need to... You need to take a moment, Steve? Or?
Yeah, I mean, like,
you want to have enough time to process the shame? Or
if it was like, you know, if you had paid for a good time there, Steve, you kind of blew your load in a minute. I mean,
no, I just remembered the exact model from the film because they mention it's a 38 Special.
Oh my God.
They do. Yeah. You are correct. You mention 38, but
you are still paying for the full hour, Steve.
Oh.
Anyway, so it's a 38 Special, right?
Yep.
With an ivory stock.
With an ivory stock.
And the Zippo lighter.
Pearl handle, I should say.
Okay. Well, there you go. That's your male stripper name. Pearl handle.
That was very quick for you, Umba.
I don't know where the fuck that came from. Oh, yeah, it was very quick. Yeah. No.
What the guys are laughing at.
Just found a bunch of fives. Okay, well, five. What's up?
What the guys are possibly laughing at as well is because I was taking a sip of ginger ale at the same time and almost choking because of what you just said.
Just how quick Umba was, yeah.
Oh, my God. Ooh. Yeah.
All right, okay. So, yeah, it's the details. The devil is in the detail in this movie. And there's another thing. Tell me if I'm the only one here, if I'm crazy. Ricky, you in particular, because Steve was sitting next to me, and I did say it out loud. The slasher sequence, because this movie turns into a full-on Laurie Strode versus Michael Myers kind of. And it's phenomenal. Man, when he starts punching his way through that wall, and it's just bang, bang. Every time that gun goes off, it's just like I was sitting on the edge of my seat, literally, and there was this thing, I think, like a wardrobe, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The gloves.
Yeah.
Yes.
There was such a Mickey Mouse nature to the way those, it's like oversized, and I just really liked it.
Yeah, they were very traditional driving gloves. And they had the very same pattern you would see on a Mickey Mouse glove. Yeah.
Just made it even weirder. Even weirder. And man, Mark Edmund Walsh closed this movie with a phenomenal, phenomenal one-liner. Because when it goes like what happens at the end, that those two bits of dialogue are kind of nailing down the point of this movie, which is one person's in shock. Another person is acting out of character, which is Maurice. I love that sequence where he turns up at Ray's place and he goes, man, you should be doing this, this. And he hears himself and then he goes, fuck, man, I shouldn't be telling you this. This shit's embarrassing. And he drives off. And I turned around to Steve and I said, dude, that's fucking, that is believable. It's funny because it's believable. Because it's like all of a sudden you're preaching to somebody, which is, what I heard was, I've done crazy shit, mate. But what you're doing right now, it's so fucked up. And he starts giving him advice. And when he hears himself giving him the advice, he goes, fuck this, man. And I love the fact that he's so embarrassed. The way he drives off, it's not in anger. It's almost in shame. It's phenomenal. Phenomenal. I just, it's so well written, dude. But then the two lines on dialogue in question, I got them in front of me. And it's when Abby shoots that last bullet, which, you know, I managed to breathe again. Because I told you, like, you start counting them. You start counting those bullets. You know that there are three bullets. Yeah, exactly. We were.
Yeah.
You know, this, at the beginning of the movie, you see when they go back to her place, she picks up the gun, she picks up the bullets. There's three bullets. We show in the chamber. We know. And then the rest of the movie, this gun keeps coming out. Mm. You know, this gun is such a catalyst for the story. It's, I can't stop talking about it. But anyway, so she has gun in hand, and she's holding that gun and trembling. Not just like someone who's just scared, but someone who's rarely used a gun as well. Yeah, this was there for her protection. She never had to use it. And that's okay. But that's, it's kind of, it's just so good, so good. Anyway, so because it's technically her gun, right?
Yeah.
And it doesn't feel like it's her gun to the point in which there is no ownership to this gun as well. It's touched and used by everyone in this.
Yeah.
You know, and if not touched or used by anyone, the protagonists of this movie are trying to implement into their whatever plan they think they have, if they had one. But here's the kicker. Like I said at the beginning, there's only one person with a plan here. And that person makes one mistake. Everyone else is in the turmoil of impulsivity. Like one of them is in the throes of jealousy, and he makes fucking crucial mistakes. The movie doesn't want you to hate on Denadaya's character either. We kind of start thinking about what he's done, but there's very little. But there is one interlude at the bar that kind of helps you in putting him into the antagonist seat a little bit. But that's it. Everything else is kind of implied, and it's what you do yourself. You put that two and two together yourself. But then again, you're kind of, wait a second, because Ray also is not a great person. You know, he doesn't seem like someone, it seems like someone who should be acting better than he is, who should be doing better. And that's why that sequence with Maurice is important, because even Maurice goes, what the fuck? Like, so the exchange between Abby and Lauren at the end, Abby shoots the gun and through the wall, because obviously she shoots the wall, and we, you know, we know that she hits whoever she thinks that's on the other side of that wall. She's shooting Ray.
Yeah. And it's through the door, isn't it? Not through a wall.
Through the wall of the door or whatever it is, but it's that, it, you know, she's still in that section of the house. And she says,
you mean Marty. She's shooting Marty.
Yeah. Marty, sorry. Marty. She thinks, because she doesn't have proof that Marty's dead, sorry.
Yeah.
So she goes, I'm not afraid of you, Marty. There's a pause, like a long pause, and then we get the last bit of this movie, which is Mark Emmett Walsh laying under a sink with a baffled look on his face. He's not angry. He's not. It's kind of, he's enjoying his last moments, and he's swimming in a sea of irony. You can see it on his face. He does that so well. And he goes, well, ma'am, if I see him, I'll sure give him the message.
And then the confusion on her face.
Yeah, which, you know, tells Abby that she just shot someone that isn't Marty.
Mm.
But also, the irony is, am I going to hell? that's the idea. Like, it's like if I see him, because that's, you know, he knows that Marty's dead because he killed him. So
what's amazing about this film
is
that the Coen brothers have a formula of what they work with on their script, and generally it's farce. You know, it's like people getting the wrong end of the stick, and this is their first feature debut film where it's full of characters getting the wrong end of the stick.
Yeah.
And part of me thought this time round, when Vissa is on the floor and he laughs about it, is that he's just put himself in a position where he's like, they know I killed him. They know he's dead. They know because I've left my lighter on the table. Mm-hmm. They know because of X, Y, and Z. Or they know because they found the picture, and the picture proves that They were dead, but they're not dead. Mm-hmm. They know all of this. But the last scene reveals to him that they didn't have a clue. They didn't have a clue that exactly. he was involved at all, which is why he laughs about it, because yeah. he's like, I've just put myself through this horrendous day of trying to track them down because I thought they knew, and I could have just left it and nobody would have been the wiser, and I could have just gone with the money. And it's so good because this whole film is full of characters who get the wrong end of the stick.
Yeah.
The biggest one being Marty. Yeah. Marty believes that his wife and her lover are dead. And so he yeah. pays the money.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's a farce. It's a complete farce. And he gets shot.
The idea is that also when you look at it in retrospect, it is so blatant about the fact that he's not, that he's gonna try and fuck with him and fuck with Visser, and Visser knows this. That's why he shoots him, I think. It's not just, I think there's a moment in which, first of all, he doesn't have the respect. There's many reasons why. Visser is, he comes across as someone who is, he doesn't particularly like a Dyer's accent either, I think. It's kind of stated when they meet. He tells him the story about what they used to do in ancient Greece, right? Mm. And he goes, I don't give a fuck, basically, but without saying it. And then the very notion, he doesn't respect him at all. Yeah. Like, there's no respect. So that's why Visser thinks, okay, I'm gonna strategize here. I'm gonna take advantage. You're gonna take your money. I'm gonna take everything. You know. So he's the one who's, the moment they meet, he goes, this guy, I can pull a con on this guy.
Yeah.
So it's funny because we're incrementally introduced to these characters that are have an imposing quality, and then the next one tops it, and then the next one tops it. Yeah. You know, and then the story takes over.
But this is where like it's important that one of the last lines Visser says while Marty is dying is who looks stupid now?
Mm-hmm.
Because us as an audience has only seen Visser as a bit, he's not stupid, but he is a bit of a bumbling fool that just wants to laugh about every little minor detail in life. And so we as an audience think, oh, you're sending this guy to do something heinous and that requires a lot of planning. He won't be able to do it. And he turns out to be the smartest individual.
Perfect cover. He's a shapeshifter. Mm. Perfect cover. He's got the perfect cover.
The guy in the shitty car, he's smoking marijuana with kids on a buff and stuff. And
how'd you break your pussy finger, mister?
Yeah.
Do you remember that bit?
Mm-hmm.
Is it like that?
Followed by Visser saying something akin to what the teenager says.
Yeah.
And then ends it with the, she thought it was, I had a rolly and she thought it was a marijuana cigarette. Must have thought I was a swinger. You know?
Yeah. He's despicable, and yet he's very entertaining as well. Like, that yellow suit was so obnoxious all the way through. but then he turns into a proper, like, very memorable villain.
Yeah.
You know, like, he's a memorable villain in this movie. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, there's a lot of memorabilia out there, including the Lauren, the Zippo. Lauren on one side.
Yeah.
Which, when we saw it on screen, I had to pause a couple of times. We watched the 4K Criterion remaster of this movie, which is beautiful. Yeah. Absolutely beautiful. For a movie made with $1.5 million in 1984, which, by the way, guys, this movie was going against on... It won an accolade against one of my favorite Scorsese pictures, which is After Hours. Mm. It's possibly one of the... After Hours and The King of Comedy are two of Scorsese's best and super underrated. And I'm not saying that like that shitty comment on Facebook or people say call something underrated that isn't underrated. They actually are. But it stole it from, it was the Independent Spirits Award. And Best Director tied with Scorsese. On the first movie, this guy's tied with Scorsese, dude. That's impressive. Absolutely impressive.
Wow.
Yes. I love it. I really, 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 really love this movie. I'm glad that we picked it because it's rare that we come across a classic that we haven't seen. And I for whatever reason, I skipped this one, you know.
So one of the things I wanted to say about Beale as well, it's very similar to the one that Delfino uses in The Big Lebowski.
Dude, I was going to say that. And he's so also good. He's also a private detective.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. With the difference Delfino was, you know, he's dead as well, man. He's dead,
man.
As well.
Yeah. We've lost so many actors over the last few years.
He was in Seinfeld. Fuck. He was phenomenal in an episode of Seinfeld. And he plays a jealous husband in Seinfeld. But Miller's Crossing is great.
It's a great movie.
What was his name, guys?
I'm going to have to have a look because I can't remember his.
Whoever gets there first. Thanks for great entertainment.
While Steve does that, because whatever.
Should I have some music in the background for this?
And thin and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes, each one she passes goes ah. When she walks, she's like a samba that swings so cool and sways so gently, that when she passes, each one she passes goes ah.
I want to talk about that similar theme that crosses a lot of films, because this time round, again, I know I mentioned it in the previous episode, but Burn After Reading came to my head, and that is a movie full of people getting the wrong end of the stick. The whole film, every character that gets built up in Burn After Reading gets the wrong end of the stick.
Yeah, but the situation spirals out of their control.
Exactly.
Like, they have so little influence over circumstance.
But in that aspect, it then reminded me of the finale of this film with the shooting through the walls, which is a very Barry. That's all because of Barry Sonnenfeld.
He's fantastic.
Especially after the trailer we saw that they used to sell the movie, which we'll talk about in a second.
Stop. Well, you gotta. So remember what you're talking about, because I sent you that this morning, and then you tried to fuck. You said
You know what? If you want, I can get Sally down here to confirm it. Straight after we watched Blood Simple, I said, watch this trailer.
To her.
To her. On the night we watched
Blood Simple. Did you say it to us?
Of course I didn't tell it you. Because why would I tell you? Because I was going to use it as a factoid. And guess what you do? You go and say, oh, look, I researched everything on the day. On the actual day. And here you go.
So tell us about the trailer that I told you about this morning.
No, I don't want to tell you about it. No, I'm talking about themes here.
Okay.
So Barry Sonnenfeld... trailer had, and the finale of the film has, the whole shooting through the wall and having those beams of light coming through, which reminded me of Burn After Reading. Because that's the scene where Brad Pitt's demise, he gets shot through a wall. And those sort of themes have stayed strong with the Coen brothers. Having those sort of like not quite knowing your assailant, your killer, not really knowing why you're there in the first place. You could even say that for No Country for Old Men, between Brolin's character and Javier Bardem's character. They don't really meet each other, but it's fantastic because they don't know each other. And it's the same themes that run through a lot of their films. Having characters.
However, the dynamic of that movie is what makes it stand out from any other movie they did. Because competence from the protagonist and the antagonist in that is stellar.
But
both of them are really good at what they do.
But this is what I'm pointing at. I'm pointing at the fact that they are so meticulous on set, which we did bring up with Raising Arizona, that it's them. And this film proves it's them. It's the writing. Yeah, it's the writing, the angles, everything, knowing their cast, you know.
It's phenomenal. Phenomenal. And then, you know, coming together, when the writing comes together from a visual standpoint with someone like Sonnenfeld, that's why they kept working together. You got lighting in a bottle. And that's why we got this movie. Steve, what were you saying?
Yeah, John Polito. Big Lebowski.
I've been
trying to get this in, but you jumped into that entire section. I was just like, I can't get a word in. Fuck.
So wait a sec, Steve. John Polito, right?
Yeah.
John Polito was the name of the Delfino.
Yeah.
The actor.
Yeah.
When did he die? When did we lose him? He was so good. That guy could do comedy. It's great. I think Miller's Crossing is when he shines the most. He does a Mark Hamill awesome now. Like, he stands out. Anyway, while you look for that.
2009.
Yeah. There's not much we can, you know, I noticed that every time we talk about a movie that it's really, really good, we do like a neat hour, hour and a half.
I think the reason is that when we know we've got a really good movie,
yeah,
and we know that it's a movie that is worth everyone's time,
yeah,
we want people to go watch it. We don't want to be the Harpers of like the Herald of like, we saw this shot. I mean, we could spend 2 hours just on the burial scene from start of picking up the body,
yeah,
getting him to the car, getting him on the road, freaking out, and then finally
there's just even one section where you've got the tail light flashing with the red light, and it's just almost poetic. That red light is that warning of everything's going off. Oh my god,
Steve, when he's trying to bury it, he's using the headlights to illuminate this thing. And then in the morning, you'll go, fuck, another fuck up, because he's trying to start the car, obviously. Yeah. Not to mention the fact that he's picked a field. We're getting an aerial shot of a field that it's, Steve pointed out, that it's freshly plowed. So you could see it from the side of the road, and all of a sudden there's a hole in it. Every single thing he does, it's a fuck up.
But even when he drives away, and we just go, oh, you got to be kidding.
But here's the key. Look, to simplify it, it's written this way, because we have seen movies where you go, what the fuck are you doing? And you're shouting at the screen. It's like, and that takes plausibility away. You start suspending disbelief, and then maybe you'll stay because the movie's good. It's worth watching for a different reason. It's funny or whatever. It's so bad, it's good. In this case, it's a rarity. It's a rarity that you have a character that makes so many fucking mistakes, and yet it's plausible. Because it's a very delicate balance you need to strike to convey that to the viewer. Because you could easily have good intentions when you write something like this, but it will come across to people that don't know anything about murder or crime in general, which is the majority of the population, thank God. They would look at something like this and go, oh, that's bullshit. That's bullshit, and lose interest. But in this case, you're invited to take that ticket. That ticket that will give you a deeper understanding that this situation is completely plausible because of what the situation is about, because of who's in it. I didn't want to talk about certain sequences because I said that we can't spoil this movie, but I'm actually officially issuing an invitation to our listeners. Please watch this movie and then you'll understand what I mean. But just remember not to be quick to judge it if you have a propensity to do that. Just remember that the people that are involved in the situations are either in a state of shock or they're oblivious to what's happening. There's a lot of assumptions being made by the protagonists of this movie in general.
We touched on Raising Arizona last episode, and what we touched on was the fight scene and how hilarious it was because of all of the mistakes they were making in such a small space in the trailer.
Mm.
This is a film where the characters are making just as many mistakes, but they add to the suspense of every single moment of the film. I don't want to go on about the burial scene stuff.
No. Mini them.
But we talked about the mini trailer. The mini trailer has that almost shot for shot already planned out.
Yeah.
The part where... The only bit that they seem to add to the trailer that they didn't use in the film was that very Sam Raimi Evil Dead shot over the top of the car.
Yeah.
Yeah, the shaky cam.
Yeah.
Which is used over the bar top at the beginning of this movie in a phenomenal
and
way.
And also up to the lead up on the bit where he's choking her. So they...
Yeah, say, over the lawn and inside the house, yes. Yeah,
which is perfect.
Yeah. There's... one thing that we need to say for our listeners, because we just keep talking about this trailer, the trailer in question and what we were fighting over, who recommended what to who, but Ricky's right, I'm just pulling his leg as usual. the trailer in question is what the Coen brothers basically shot as the modern equivalent of a pilot. They shot it as a trailer, and they shot it specifically with the purpose of going around looking for investors to make this movie. But what we didn't say is that the actor starring in the trailer is Bruce Campbell. So, did we pique your interest? Mm-hmm. Yoda Bane, whatever. just go on YouTube.
That's terrible.
Yeah, I know. Yoda Bane?
Yoda Bane.
For fuck's sake.
In the shadows you were born. Yes, Bruce Campbell was starring in the trailer. So all you need to do is go on YouTube, type in trailer, Blood Simple, Campbell or Bruce, and you'll see it. And it's actually really well shot as well. You know?
Yeah.
But they were coming off Evil Dead because, you know, the Coen brothers, like we stated earlier, before in another episode, they were friends with Raimi. So there was that kind of camaraderie. This is like the 80s equivalent of Zoetrope in the 70s. You know, like Coppola and Spielberg and Lucas and
Scorsese,
De Palma, all these guys used to hang out together. So we missed a director and someone is screaming, right? And listening to this episode, we missed somebody that belongs to Zoetrope. Who did we miss?
No, Scorsese. I thought you got all of them.
Okay, well, whatever. Whatever.
But they ultimately raised $75,000.
For what?
Doing this trailer.
For doing the trailer, yeah.
Yeah, so, and shopping around. So that was in nearly a year. Mm. So that's fantastic. I mean,
it is.
Yeah.
It is. The movie actually, this movie as well, was their first and made it the money back.
Yeah.
It's like 2.7 million or whatever. It's an anomaly. It's an anomaly to, you try and do that today and it's cheaper and get your money back.
There was a point, though, where they thought they completely failed. They were trying, this was, the reason they delayed on making Raising Arizona is because their distribution company just kept being like, we don't know how to sell this film. So even though they had been to Sundance and they showed everything, their company that were going to distribute their film go, look, we're going to delay it again. We're going to delay it again. So by the time they started Raising Arizona, this film had not been properly released. So they thought, we've crapped out. There's no way anybody's going to let us make films again. So even though we have our second script, what are we going to do? And I think it was just during pre-production that they finally said, look, we'll distribute Blood Simple. And thank God, because that raised the support for Raising Arizona even more.
And we talked about the set pieces of this movie. We talked about the writing structure, which is stellar. Also, the dialogue, it's an essential part of why this script works, and it's minimal. There's no fat on this movie. Oh. It's super lean. It's just so tight. It's just so, so tight. And from the beginning, when Marty's talking to Ray, and he's saying, don't worry, she's gonna say to you, I haven't done anything funny at some point. And she does.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it's also the way she utters that line when she utters it is, it's like, okay, she thinks this, it's a complete assumption. She's oblivious to what's happening, not because she doesn't have the ability of understanding the gravity of the situation, but it's circumstantial. Every single thing that happens here kind of leads somebody to believe that this is happening for a different reason. It's so good. Again, I put Visser atop all of this. And the funny thing is that Visser, you know, to add to the irony, Ricky, I'm thinking about it now. Visser is the guy that says to Marty, why don't you go fishing? You should go fishing.
Yeah.
And that very fish is the reason. The fish ends up on top of his lighter, man. It's just gold. Absolutely.
There's just so much poetic irony throughout the script, and it's so perfectly done. And you don't feel it. You don't go. So we were watching The Cell last night, Sally and myself, And there was a moment where they said something like, oh, the neural pathways are such a way that you enter their mind. We never go the other way. You never let them enter your mind. And straight away you go, at some point in the film, they're going to do that.
Yeah.
In this film, even though when you look at it, look back on it, you go, oh, of course it went like that. And of course that happened. And of course this was going to happen. And of course the light, something was going to be left behind to make everybody realize. But they're not essential to the plot. They are like little moments where it's like everybody is making mistakes in this movie. But those mistakes don't directly lead to people's downfalls. It's just, it's paced so well. But they are
highlighted at the beginning. We get the highlight of the lighter. Mm. We get the highlight of the safe. We get the highlights of the gun. So all of, and even to the point where they highlight the burning all the trash.
The incinerator.
Incinerator.
From a narrative standpoint, I'm speechless because it's so genius and it's simple. It's blood simple. It's simple at the same time. If you look like, you know, when you write, if you write a script, right, and you're developing narrative threads for the post-it notes are a great thing. Color-coded post-it notes to write, right? And I picture these four parallel lines of different colors. And one of them is Visa. One of them is Marty, one of them is
Ray,
Ray, and one of them is Abby, and another five, and another one is Maurice.
Mm-hmm.
The only one that would have to intersecate the others, pretty much the most, is Visa's line. It's the yellow line, right? Because that's his suit. But then the rest are pretty much straight lines, because they go through the entire movie with the belief of a narrative that is just inside their head. So they've got their own arc, but none of them match the actual reality of what's happening. The only one that zigzags across all of them, besides Maurice, who's on the outside of this, is Visa. And it's a genius way to write, because you're giving this fictional character their own version of the truth. And they run with it from the moment the movie starts to the end. It's fucking...
Like the way that Ray is sweating and is so beside himself, and he's blaming Abby for all of it. He's like, yes! It's your gun. And what do you mean you don't know? It's your gun. I don't want to talk about it, but it was your gun. So of course you know. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
the betrayal that she experienced when you see it. And kudos to Frances McDormand for that performance, because it's very subtle. But the betrayal she experienced for a moment, it's on her face. Of Ray's stealing. He's stealing the money. So he's with me. He loves me because of the money. It's like, and it's insane, because he's the opposite. He does a crazy fucking thing he's never done before, because all of a sudden he realizes he's in love. He's not. Like, it's a fucking disaster, man.
And the best thing about the Visa character is that the only person he really meets is Marty. He only really meets Marty, and everybody else he kind of, like, you know, they're asleep when he invades their home and takes those pictures. Mm-hmm. He sneaks into the room, but then into the apartment, but then walks out. He's viewing them from afar on the sniper lens. Mm-hmm. He doesn't actually really meet anybody apart from Marty.
Yeah,
but he is the essential
job, right?
Yeah, and he is the essential cog for this whole film.
Yeah.
Even though, again, if you probably, like, timed as much as you'd see the character, he's probably only in about 40% of the film.
Yeah. I like how, again, no fat on this movie, when Marty goes to the bathroom, there's a sign.
Yeah.
There's a printed
great sign. Yeah.
Yeah, and that ends up inside the envelope later. It's... Yeah. Mate,
But anyway, please wash your hands.
yeah, absolutely. I guess the music's great. It's a great score. There's a lot of stuff made by Carter Burwell, who's worked with the Coen brothers again.
Yeah.
Mm. I think he was on Raising Arizona and then other pictures as
well.
He was
the Yodeler.
Yeah. Yeah. Was he? Was
it him? Yeah. He's the Yodeler.
Okay.
I don't know if
it was
a tribute
to another track, right?
Yeah.
I think.
I don't know if even or Joel Like, so I don't know which one of them said to him, but they basically turned around to him and said, you're going to be asked to do a lot of farming out on the farm, horse pictures, you know that. And he was like, ha, 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 ha. But they were right.
You know, those few kind of melancholic notes, like, I kept turning around to Steve and going, mate, this sounds like Nine Inch Nails. Like, there's so many. And I'm pretty sure that Trent must have paid respects to this, because I think I watched an interview somewhere where he said that this is one of his favorite movies. And I fully understand it. But also there are other tracks that are tracks on the outside of this. Like Steve said earlier, the track in the bar is perfectly placed. For a purpose as well. Because also the camera kind of pans around and you see the face of some people when that song comes on. And it's not full disgust, but it's a mild disapproval.
Yeah.
Yeah. And can I just also point out, Barry Sonnenfeld had just come out of film school.
Wow, he's good, man.
And
the shots
just
are good.
That tracking shot. Again, we're talking about the bar. We're talking so early in the film, but that tracking shot of his Converses to the other side of the bar.
Yeah,
perfect.
And
there was not even a bip. There wasn't even a camera drop or anything. It was so good.
Doesn't he say there's an exchange between Maurice and Marty at the bar at the beginning when, you know, he's giving him the laydown of how the night went, and he wins, you know, like the deuce at the end of the bar. It's implying that someone's passed out at the end of the bar. Like, it's like a turd, right? And
yeah.
I think that the camera, when the camera does that, does it go over the guy?
It raises up, lowers back down as it tracks over the top of him.
Yeah, yeah. It's perfect. I think it goes over the deuce, right?
Yeah.
Oh, I think it's ratings time. There's
definitely.
What else are we gonna do here?
Again, we
without spoiling
so much
more of a money movie. Money.
Yeah, as much as we didn't want to spoil, I feel like we've probably spoiled too much, but my goodness, if you are listening to this and you're still like, oh, this sounds like a good film, no, just go
now. Just
go
watch
now.
Put
yourself in a room for only, what was it, an hour and a half?
Yeah,
it's only an hour and a half.
Flies, the movie flies, and you want to know more.
So well.
And actually, the performances, I think, are very believable. This is how real people would act in these situations. And I suggest you put your phone on silent, put it away, leave it. We had a friend coming over, Kalle, shout out to you. Kalle is a good friend of mine. He has a tendency to grab his phone when we watch stuff. He barely did for this, and if he did, he did to look for factoids that we could use in this show. So he was helping us out. And this movie is, just watch it. Just watch this fucking movie. Don't be Blood Simple. Watch this movie.
Yeah.
And if you want the actual Criterion Collection actual number, it's 834.
In our show notes, you will see a link to the Criterion Shop. And don't worry, it won't just be the American one.
Mr. Spader, there aren't any fucking show notes.
Oh, there aren't any show notes. Well,
bitch.
That's an oversight. Man, I mean, I've been dealing with this show for quite some time, and I keep hearing show notes, but you know what? I really think that you've got an attitude with me, bitch.
Guys, it's ratings time.
Who
wants to go first? Ricky, go.
I'm giving this a one.
Reiki.
No.
Reiki. Go, Reiki.
Can you imagine? This is 1 out of 10 because it put me in a bad mood.
Dude.
No. I'll say. I am going to give this one an 8.4 out of 10. This film has really made me look at the way Coen Brothers construct their films. If they're this tight and this well thought out from feature film number one, then it should be utilized to have a look at so many of their other films. I haven't seen, for example, Inside Llewellyn Davis. Is that the one? Inside Llewellyn Davis?
With Oscar anyway. Isaac.
Yeah. I haven't seen that one because a lot of people said, oh, it's a little ploddy and all of that stuff. But after watching this, I might sit down and watch it and just try and see the same motifs that they use consistently. So it's an 8 point, did I say 8.2 or 8.1?
8.4.
Did I say 8.4? Sorry.
Yeah.
8.4 fishes from a weekend trip away on a table.
Cool, cool. Well done, Steve.
So I'm giving it an 8.5. I really enjoyed this movie. Fantastic movie for me, to be perfectly honest. And I'm not going to go into any spoilers, but I'm just going to say it's 8.5 broken fingers.
Not bad. Not bad. Not bad. Okay. This is a 9 for me.
Ooh.
That's possibly the highest rating I've given to a movie on the show. It has now almost, and I'll say this as praise, but not in retrospect, but now I think that this is, it's possibly already, by modern standards, anyone that is interested in film production or writing, I think that this would be an example that would keep coming up.
100%.
And I'll say this with praise. It has almost a didactic quality, and I don't, and usually I use that as an insult, and that's not the case here. I think this is a perfect example of how, if you wanted a foundation on how to write a character arc, this movie does it really well, and it does it really well for all five. You know, like it's, I felt rejuvenated after what? Rejuvenated Arnold Schwarzenegger. Even he's doing his voice in his own trailer, by the way. Arnold Schwarzenegger this summer. He's rejuvenated. I woke up in the morning, I felt full of energy. Why? He's doing both roles as well.
I answer my own questions now. Yes, I do.
The unbearable weight of dumbbell. I'm just saying. I'm sorry about that. I don't know where that came
from.
That's
just my Frank and beans.
All I'm trying to say is I highly recommend that you watch this movie as soon as possible. Put your phone away. Don't watch it in the company of a lot of people. If you have a close friend or a partner, watch it with them. Make sure you're not tired. Not that the movie requires you not to be tired. It will reel you in very quickly. As a disclaimer, I better state this now. If you didn't like this movie, you made two mistakes: watching the movie and listening to this podcast. We don't want you to listen to us. You hear me? Go and rent a copy of Borderlands with Kevin Hart. Watch that on repeat until you expire. Do that. All right? Thank you very much.
God, that's like hell.
Yeah, I'm taking this out. By the way.
To those listeners who took that on board, I will give you a safe space. I'll put you under my wing.
It's not safe. Don't go there. No, it's like Barbarian. Don't go there. In that basement?
This basement behind me. I'll just go check what's in there. Don't worry. Stay up here. I'll just go check down there.
Got milk?
Wait, that's Don't Breathe, right?
No, that's Barbarian. And on that note, this was Umba.
This was Steve.
And this is Ricky.
Bye.
See yas.